It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
All right, away we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. And yes, Mike Ward is on assignment. That happens a lot during turkey season. It's all right. We'll get Mike with us back next week for more turkey stories. It's been a good start to turkey season for me, and hopefully for you out there. Turkey's been doing it even on days they weren't supposed to be doing it, you know, when it was low pressure and foggy and stuff. Nobody told them that they weren't supposed to do it, so it's been good, and we've had some good hunts. And I'd love for y'all to drop us a picture, drop us a line over on our Facebook page, facebook.com/FMTalk1065Outdoors. All right, and on this week's show, so we're talking about long-range, not long-range turkey, although we might. My friend Logan Copeland from Surgical Precision is in to talk about shooting long-range, but I wouldn't let him get to that before we started talking about turkeys. Logan, thanks for being here. I'm going to get you pulled close to that mic here. So, I mean, surgical precision shooting for turkeys.
Oh, man.
throw you a curveball. So this is we're going to talk about you and teaching surgical precision shooting and what you did with me and what you do with so many students. But beforehand, you're also a renaissance man, not just long-range shooting. You like to hunt a turkey, too.
I've got a problem. It's caused me some financial problems and have a hard time wanting to go to work this time of year, you know?
Well, so talk to me about that. So this is what's cool. So I know Logan, we're personal friends as well, not just hunting here. He's got we'll talk about this in the big game world, but you traveled out of state. You've gone different places turkey hunting.
Oh, yeah.
So we've been talking about this on the show over the last few weeks, too. Other than Alabama, I just want to hunt at home. What state do you want to, what state do you like to hunt most, or what state do you want to hunt most turkeys in?
Well, I am one of the few that has an affliction that one day just decided I was going to try and get a U.S. Super Slam.
Yeah, yep.
So, like, it don't matter what state, as long as I can get another state.
Okay, so you're how many states in?
Last year I did 3.
Okay.
This year, between life, you know, trying to work life and family hunting balance, should I say.
Yeah. Welcome to old people world, man.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't think I may try and get Mississippi. I don't have Mississippi, and it's actually.
Yeah, I don't have Mississippi turkey
right
either.
Right here.
Yeah.
I tried, actually. I have went one day in Mississippi.
I got
this
a spot here. When we go to the break, we'll talk about it. Maybe we'll set up a trip.
That'd be awesome.
But this is you traveling to other states to hunt Eastern. What about subspecies? Are you, I know Florida. You gone after Osceolas?
Yeah, I have a slam. I've taken a few Osceolas all on public land. That's a unique hunt. It's a hard hunt. I may get hammered for what I'm about to say here.
I'm taking notes.
When it pertains to the Osceola, Osceola turkeys, in my experience, they're not as hard to hunt as a heavy pressured Eastern bird.
I don't think there is anything. This is something that I've talked about for years, and I think I probably stole it from Preston Pittman years ago. He and I were talking. If you grow up where we grew up and you can kill turkeys anywhere here, let alone on public land, like we've both done, it's like swinging two bats when you go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Now, conversely,
put Mississippi, it's South Alabama, South Mississippi. Right, into that mix. And then if you can kill turkeys there, you can probably kill turkeys anywhere.
I'd say Georgia.
And
Georgia, okay, too.
And I've not hunted Georgia.
Yeah, and maybe Louisiana, I think, is a challenging state because it doesn't.
There's not so many places.
Yeah. Right? So it's a lot harder to find a place that has birds in Louisiana.
Right.
You know, but conversely, like last year I hunted the Dakotas.
Yeah.
Not the same turkey hunt. It was a little challenging in its own way, but I didn't get I was very successful, and it was more glassing. There's a minimal roosting site. You're glassing from distance. I know that there's a high chance birds are going to be in these trees because it's like the only clump of trees for a long way.
Yeah, this is like I say about my one hunt for Rios when I was in my 20s, and it was, compared to South Alabama turkeys, it was very easy to be, and those birds roosted on power lines I was, so we could see them when it was roost time. You just went with glass, sat out there, and watched them all pitch up on the big H-bracket power lines, and you go, okay, well, there's three gobblers on that one. There's four here. There's hens there. There's Jake's there. I know in the morning to be near this power line upright to go hunt them.
You know, something else that's crazy about, you know, hunting in that terrain, what we can call it, maybe that high prairie terrain, the birds have nowhere to go when a predator shows its face, mm-hmm. such as you or I or mm-hmm. a coyote. And it was a little wild to me to see these birds would get spooked. If, go spook a bird here in southern Alabama yeah. and see if you can find him afterwards.
Yeah, he's gone into a foxhole. Yeah,
right. These birds would run across the prairie, maybe half a mile, and just lay down in the grass.
You mean about like squatting down?
Squat down in the grass. They had nowhere to go.
I never thought about that part of it.
It blew my mind.
Yeah, where I was in Texas, it was that mix, like the lower trees, but like mesquite trees and all that kind of stuff. You couldn't, but they didn't have any big trees to roost in. They had stuff to go kind of hide in. But yeah, now I'm picturing I got to get this Dakotas hunt in. So, you're three states last year. Hopefully, you get. We'll talk Mississippi at the break.
Yeah. Maybe okay. Mississippi and Alabama this year. I will say, rolling back into long range, you know, good kind of chance I'll get hammered for this as well.
Okay, good.
I do shoot a 3.5-inch 12 gauge with TSS.
Oh gosh, man. So are you a long range turkey shooter too?
I'm not. Almost all of my turkeys I kill at like, I don't know, 20 yards.
Yes.
And this is why, because I'm always putting myself in setups where they can't see where I'm calling from.
Correct.
Until I can shoot them.
Yes.
But this is just something I told myself years ago. If I'm gonna put that much work in, or I'm gonna travel and hunt, if I shoot at him and miss him, at least I can say I gave him the biggest shell I could find.
True. That's true. Well said. And by the way, so we will get in the discussion rest of the show here. And once again, not only a turkey freak like the rest of us, he is a founder, lead instructor at Surgical Precision. Surgical Precision is a long-range shooting school. I am one of his flawed students of this school. But there's a lot to talk about with this. You didn't, you know, you're one of us down here. You weren't born, you're younger than me, but you weren't exactly born into the long-range shooting world. Did you? You didn't come out, you know, you come out of the hospital and go, all right, I need to make some long shots.
No. A 30-30 Winchester my grandfather, one of my grandfathers, he had a old single shot, actually a Thompson Center. It was more modern, but a 223 of all things.
Okay.
And would give me one round and would be like, hey, if you miss...
Yeah,
this is it. And like his idea of marksmanship training was we'd zero the rifle, and I crap you not, we'd put a sweet potato cull in a cull sweet potato, mm-hmm. you know. He'd go put it in a tree at like 100 yards and be like, shoot that potato, boy.
And
it, pow. And if I hit it, he's like, here's your second round. Here's your round.
He wasn't judging like a minute of angle from one part of the potato to the other.
No,
like,
just minute of potato, whatever.
So you started out like that, like all of it. Yeah. I mean, you didn't start off shooting long range.
So I actually was not a good shot.
What?
Yeah, believe it or not, man, I missed a lot of deer.
Now, was that making the shot, or was that just the buck fever? I mean, I know those things
probably
together,
a combination of both, you know? So, all right. So when one of my very first experiences with shooting a firearm wasn't, you know, like you see nowadays where guys, I'm going to get my son a 22 and then we'll move him to an AR-15. Mm-hmm. My grandfather had a big hand in raising me, and they thought it was funny when I was very young to let me shoot a single barrel 20 gauge with buckshot.
Ah,
they're like, yeah, boy,
hammer gun.
going out there and there's a stump. I'm just mm-hmm. shooting at a stump. So I throw the gun up, boom, shoot, it kicks the dickens out of me, right?
Same thing happened to me when I was young. They didn't even tell me my first shotgun shooting. They didn't say square it to your shoulder. I was just holding it. So it had that distance to go ahead and hit me.
Yeah, just point it at that stump, boy. Mm-hmm. Shoot it. Mm-hmm. You can do it. Next thing you know, I'm crying.
Yep.
Guns on the ground, and I'm recoil shy. Yeah.
So you not only didn't grow up, you weren't born as a long-range shooter, you had that recoil shy part of it.
Right. So I had the double whammy, man.
There's young Logan Copeland. He's got to get going through shooting at sweet potatoes. Gonna hunt 30-30, not exactly long range weapon.
Yeah,
100 yards and in.
Yeah.
So you now to get from there to where you are now, not only master marksman but somebody who teaches other folks.
Right.
How'd that happen?
Well, all right. So I'll try to be relatively concise. We'll see here. So I was always interested in long range shooting, just hunting. Like, what person has grown up hunting down here with it being a passion and not looked across a cutover or down a gas line and been like, man, if I could shoot across that.
Yeah.
If that buck came out on that tree line, man,
God. Yeah, that's true.
I'd kill the state record if I could shoot 500 yards.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that it was like that for me. Man, when I was a kid, I used to be infatuated with Carlos Hathcock. And me and my cousin, we grew up on a farm down in Grand Bay. And, man, I was probably like 9 or 10 years old reading Marine Corps Scout Sniper, his the book about his life, you know, sewing ghillie suits. I had my pellet gun. I was crawling around in a ghillie suit, proverbially sniping animals around the farm. That's what I thought. That's how I felt, you know. So it was just something that always interested me. And then I remember one day I was hunting with my grandfather up in up off John Johnston Road up in Washington County. And I missed a doe at probably 120 yards, 270, Remington 780L.
Right.
I missed her like three times, dude. What does it hold? Three or four rounds,
yeah,
I think it
two,
held.
You can put one in the tube. Yeah, so yeah, three.
Yep. I missed that deer, dude, 130 yards. And I remember that day I was like, I'm going to become a better shot. I think that was kind of more doe fever, you know, because I could hit stuff with the pellet gun. I'd walk around and played.
Yeah, but then the size of the target got in your way.
Right.
Okay, we're going to come back for the break. More with Logan Copeland. He is the founder, lead instructor with Surgical Precision. He, like I said, I'm one of his bad students, but he's got great students as well. How he can teach us to shoot long distance. We'll talk about that when we return. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan. Mike Ward is on assignment. Probably has something to do with hunting a turkey. And like I said, it's been a good start to this first week of turkey season. More stories to come on next week's show. Also, even though he's in to talk about long-range shooting, I had to start off talking with the turkeys with the long-range shooter here. Not that he's shooting turkeys long-range. He likes to hunt turkeys like we do, and he likes to shoot rifles long-range. Logan Copeland, founder and lead instructor of Surgical Precision. And it is a school that even could help me on long-range shoot. You know, you talked about missing that deer at 130 yards, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about that. And you now, you're focused on, at a young age, saying, I'm going to get better at this.
Right.
Instead of just saying, oh, well.
Right.
It's a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, but you didn't. You said, I'm going to do something about this. So what did you do?
So, well, first, you know, when it comes into what goes into long-range shooting, I'm sure we'll get into a bunch of that later, potentially. There's so much subject matter here. We could be here for days. But, I started reading books, like the long-range shooter's hand guide. I bought the Army Sniper Manual before I was ever even in the Army. You can get it as a publication.
Right.
And I was reading that thing, you know? So I just was really infatuated with it. I wasn't necessarily like anything. Just a dude that had he was nerding out about, right?
You found your calling because you are a nerd. We're going to get into that too.
Yeah.
That it's not just wow, I can make a shot. It's the why you can make that shot at distance thing. So you're reading that. Yeah. You're reading that stuff. You're into long range shooting before you ever enlist and go into the Army.
Before any of it. So I ended up joining the Army, signed up as a parachute rigger. Worst job in the Army.
My gosh.
You're held to packing a lot of chutes. It's actually hard work. And there's
And everybody's dependent on you to do it right.
Yeah, there's always pressure, man. Everybody's jumping your chutes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'd be like, they walk by and be like, dude.
Dude, when I packed.
Can't have a bad Friday or sleepy Monday.
When I jumped the first chute that I packed myself, I thought this is it. No more hunting for me.
That's right. You know? It was, so, I mean, you do that. You go in, but you didn't go in. Here's your guardian to long-range shooting, but you're telling me you're packing chutes.
Packing parachutes, man. And
they don't have you out doing long-range shooting?
No, man. I joined up as a parachute rigger. My recruiter was good at recruiting.
Yeah.
He got me to be a parachute rigger.
Okay.
At a young age, at 21, I went, I didn't like that job. I wanted to be a Green Beret. That's what I wanted to do. So I went to Special Forces Assessment Selection at 21, made it through, but got what's called boarded or a 21-day non-select. Basically, I had some maturity issues, you know, probably talking, you know. As a 21-year-old, that was a kind of a big blow to me. So I ended up going through that. I come back, and I'm backpacking parachutes after I'd spent months training for all this, going through this super hard selection, and now I'm like, God, darn. And they were like, you can't come back for 2 years either. Like, you got to, you know, they depending on the type of non-select you get, they'll give you a different time frame on when you can come back
and see us in X.
Yeah. If you got maturity issues, you probably give you a couple years. Okay. Right? So I come back and I don't want to be a parachute rigger.
We've determined this is not for you.
So I ended up making some phone calls and I was like, what can I do that makes me valuable? Well, also, it's interesting to note. So this is like some National Guard time, right? And so I have a simultaneous regular life going on outside of the Army. I tried a little stint in construction and realized that wasn't my forte.
That wasn't your calling?
Yeah. I needed the Army had done a lot of good things in my life, and I needed structure like that. I wanted a corporal. I wanted a sergeant. I wanted that regimented lifestyle, right? So I went and knocked on the front door to the Mobile County Sheriff's Office, and lo and behold, a long story later, got hired by these guys, you know, right after that. Maybe, I don't know, dude, maybe 6 months or 9 months after selection. So anyways, I'm going through some stuff, sometimes being a rigger. I had to find a way to make money, right? Had to find a career. So I've become a cop. And I ended up wanting to switch jobs. And even though I couldn't go be a Green Beret, right? So I made some phone calls and I was like, what's valuable? What can I do that's going to make me valuable?
Yeah.
You know, and I think at one point, one guy was like, well, I got water purification. I was like, I don't want to do that. I was like, he was like, well, I need medics. I was like, medics sound valuable.
Yeah,
that's a real valuable job.
Yep.
I was like, I'll go do that. So I end up going, reclassing to a combat medic, moving companies, still in the same unit and on the support side of the house of a special forces unit. Once I graduate that, I get approached. I guess they don't think I was going to graduate and actually become a medic. I get approached. They're like, wow, you did really good. I went to a really class. I became an EMT in 30 days.
Wow.
Reclass. So they were like a
smart kid. Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's just or just I didn't want to go back to packing parachutes.
Yeah, that's a good motivator, yes.
So they were like there's this course called the Special Operations Combat Medic course. And I was like, wow, what's that? They're like, well, it's like the 18 Delta, which is like a special force as a Green Beret medic, it's basically the major part of that course. You can go to Fort Bragg anyway just as a medic, and you can become a special operations combat medic. And now then you can start, like, you know, that opens up doors to work at the team level and, like, really, you know, really get you, like, as close as I could get to achieving my dream at the time, right?
Okay.
So, dude, I go up there, and I passed.
All right.
You know?
Very good. No more parachutes for you.
Yeah. So I go up there, spend about, for me, I think it's like 15, 16 months up in glorious North Carolina. I did hunt some turkeys while I was there.
So you got North Carolina on your list. Okay. Very good.
So I end up graduating that. I come back to group, and now here I am, a freshly minted special operations combat medic. At the same time, before I had left, I had a little bit of time in patrol at the sheriff's office, and shortly, it kind of all happened fast. A lot of these things happened fast. I was asked, hey, man, you want to try out for the SWAT team?
That's what I'm saying. Did whether it be on the law enforcement side or the Army side, did they yet know that you could shoot, that you were a long-range shooter?
Like in boot camp, I was like shot expert, always. Okay. You know, but like so does every boy from the South generally hunts, right? So nothing special.
Okay.
Like yeah, this guy can shoot and is pretty good in the woods. Seems like he's having a good time out here. He's supposed to not be having a good time.
Yeah, we like this stuff, yeah.
So I'm doing that, and I end up making the SWAT team with Mobile County. Awesome group of guys that really shaped my career. Very thankful for that. So as time progresses, I'm doing that for like, I don't know, we'll just move forward maybe a year, a year and a half, two. The timeline.
Right. There's
a lot of timeline I'm trying to remember right now. So at some point, I'm doing multiple jobs at MCSO. One of those jobs is being on the SWAT team. I'm also being a medic, special operations combat medic at the group level. At this point, I end up kind of stamping out as a kind of a leader in marksmanship at the company level. So I was an E4 at the time, and I was leading the company individual weapons qualification.
Yeah, shoot, kind of upside down. Yeah.
So, you're not supposed to be doing that, right. But they don't care. That's one thing good about, SOF is that, like, if you put a round peg in a round hole, we don't care what's on his chest. We don't care if this dude can do the job. Yeah, put him there, which is – I really love
so
that.
You're shooting with some of the best shooters.
Oh, yeah. Right? Well, not quite there. At that point, I am also becoming what I still call myself today, a student of the craft. I got that. That's a term that comes from another group of instructors in this world. But always willing to learn, always wanting to learn. So in my meantime, I had traded in my old 270 for a 308 Remington SPS 700, mm-hmm. right? The varmint?
Yes.
The 26-inch 1 in 12 twist, slow twist 308. And, dude, I remember I was laying in the back of a truck in some family's farm down in Grand Bay, and I put a 3-inch pasty on a cardboard box and set it out at like 350, 400 yards. And I've been reading all these books and learning all this stuff mm-hmm. about MOA and stuff. And I was like, I don't know. We'll see if this math works. And I did it, right? It's only 300 or 400 yards. Nowadays, I know that, your atmospheric, your air pressure, temperature, humidity, they're not going to affect you that much at 300. I mean, that depends on like, you know, what powders and stuff you're using. But I shoot the shot, man. And then I walk down there and the bullet is in the damn 3-inch pasty.
And
I'm like, man.
Okay.
This math works.
Yeah.
This is crazy, you know?
Because that's what I want to get into. So, and as we go into what you're doing now with this, I get questions on that. The math works. I'm going to jump forward here because,
I told you this a long story.
Because you taught me, too, like I wrote this note when I was in your class, that there's a lot more to than just gravity affecting the bullet at long range.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
You know, I mean, we all just kind of think the arc. We all saw the drawings in Field and Stream. Here's the arc of the bullet and all that. But you are a student of it. You sat down with me, and you had my head worrying with the things that are – it's not just gravity with that bullet.
So we can move on to, like, interesting stuff. I'll jump back real quick to that timeline. Yeah. So kind of, like, work slowly. So where did my life go? At one point, man, in my life, I was leading the training for the sniper section for the SWAT team here. I was training other agencies' snipers. I was a competition shooter. I'm a plank holder for the Alabama National Guard Precision Rifle Team. It's part of the Alabama National Guard Governor's 20. So it's like the top best 20 shooters in the state. I made that team. And then I was selected to start a team that runs around and shoots sniper matches for recruiting for the Army. On top of that, I got asked to go to the Special Forces Sniper School because I was already already shooting long range. So it just turns out where on my medic job, I'm doing the medic thing and the like sniper guru at the team level.
Right.
I'm doing an extra drill with the Army just for competition shooting, and I'm doing sniper stuff here on the home front at the sheriff's office.
Did you sleep any?
No, not a lot.
You know? Coming back, we're going to talk about more of this long-range shooting for the man, Logan Copeland, who is the man. He was my professor here, and he didn't pass me so much as he just got me out of there. We'll talk about that when we come back. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Mike Ward will be back with us next week. Our guest, Logan Copeland. By the way, too, in the meantime, you can pull that mic close to you as well. People want to look you up right now as we're talking. I'm a follower of your Facebook page and website, but if somebody's never been there, how do they find you?
Yeah, it's surgicalprecisiontraining.com.
Okay, so surgical. By the time on Facebook, I can tell y'all get surgical precision Facebook usually fills in the rest of it. But Surgical Precision Training.
Right. Yeah, .com, and it'll take you right to it. Either the Facebook page is Surgical Precision, the Instagram Surgical Precision, the website, like I said, surgicalprecisiontraining.com.
You know, it's a real testament, too, Logan, that from wanting to do this as a kid, just saying, hey, I'm going to get better at making these long shots, to now we've evolved through the place that you're shooting with special operations. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the best shooters out there. Mm-hmm. And when y'all meet Logan and you go to his class, you'll realize it's not all just on the range. Y'all are a bunch of nerds, and it's a good thing. But I mean, because you have to, you know why the bullets do what they do. But it's there's a lot to this.
It is. That's a ton, you know. And I'll say,
not just hold high. Y'all hold high. I mean, how many we all kind of grew up just hold high at 200. You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, back on what you just said with soft being, you know, maybe the best. You know, sorry with my brothers if I crap on this a little bit. Debatable. Realistically, man, this if you look in society nowadays. Go watch your Facebook feed. Long range shooting's everywhere, dude. Well, we're in the golden age.
That's I wanted to ask you because I wrote it as a note here. I said, you know, last 10 years or 15 years, in my estimation, long range shooting's become a big thing.
Right.
So why?
Well,
that's my first question is the why.
I think a lot of people have wanted to shoot long range, mm-hmm. right? But the availability of information and people that could do it, man, when I 10 years ago, when you were getting into this, you just talked to some guy and he'd be like, oh, yeah, I did this and learned this from this guy. Like, I had a guy tell me that I had to have a stable table to shoot off of to hit 1,000 yards. And now I'm shooting 1,000 yards off of a log.
Yeah.
So it's like.
Yeah, that information wasn't, you know, we would, like you said, I mean, we'd see Army snipers and movies about them or whatever, but that wasn't anything that we really talked about that much in the hunting world. I mean, right. People like to make long shots and stuff, but, and I wrote this note here. So, Logan, what do you think? Is it the rounds, the optics, the barrels, the rangefinders, the actions? What is it that made long-range shooting more achievable? He's pointing at me now. What?
The availability of information.
And so it's info before all those. It's the info.
It's weaponized math.
I like that. Weaponized
math.
It's
a weaponized math.
Because you
club.
Said just in the last segment, you said you it was the math part of it that helped you lay in the back of that truck and make that shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's a system, right? They're all equally important. You know, number one, let's say if you have an optic that, you know, a lot of guys in the hunting world run Swarovski, great glass, some of the best glass, get their glass from Zeiss, but their coatings are really, really good. I think they do an excellent job.
Right.
A lot of their, if you can have the best glass in the world, but if you don't have a scope that's graduated with like external elevation and windage turrets, in either MILS or MOA, where you can actually turn that turret and it be repeatable, it don't matter how good a glass you have.
Yeah.
Conversely, your rangefinder. You know, you like to say, oh, well, I shot this deer at 500 yards and I made a first-round impact. No, you didn't. You had to shoot it with a rangefinder first.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, too. The rangefinders were a thing that, you know, really, and only I remember coming up with bow hunting.
Mm-hmm.
People early on were talking about the rangefinder. You know, we used to do the step off and this tree, and then go climb up the tree.
Yeah.
But that was the thing talking, but that was talking about 50 yards, 40 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, like, okay, there's other rangefinders, but where you are now, you know, the equipment you use, you know, you're looking at very long distances and knowing accurately, not it's past 500. You can tell it's 1,013 yards.
That rock is 2,137 yards.
Yeah.
I'm getting 2,137, 2,138.
It's not, we're not estimating or guessing now. We know for a fact the thing is there.
Yeah. I mean, something that's super common with laser rangefinders, and you only see it at long distance, is knowing your laser rangefinder, knowing how to use it. Guys, there's a huge misconception where guys like, I'm just going to go buy the best, maybe a set of SIG Kilo Gen 2s or Vortex Talon 10Ks or the Swaro L ranges or something like that, right? I teach a 1 hour, it really usually doesn't go an hour, but it can go up to an hour, block of instruction that I title, laser rangefinding is not a mindless task. So you don't just buy a laser rangefinder, turn it on, put a battery in it, turn it on, you look through it and hit a button. Oh, it says 800, it must be 800.
That's kind of what I wanted to do when I came to see you.
Yeah, doesn't work. You got beam divergence, you know, how large or the size of your laser range finding beam. You have first mode, best mode, last mode. And believe it or not, not all laser rangefinders come sighted in. So just because you have crosshairs doesn't mean at 1,100 yards that laser beam's hitting dead in the center of those crosshairs. You have to learn your rangefinder.
So, and you showed me a bunch of that. And then we don't have time right now to talk about it on today's show, but people will get this when they go to class. So we got that distance. And then, like I said, it's not just gravity affecting the bullet. It's not just wind out there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of other stuff. Like Logan had me thinking about where I was on planet Earth with right. my rangefinder. That made a difference.
Right. Let's
We're leaving here. I was going to Utah. You're like, okay, well, where in Utah?
You know, what changes? Calibrate. Yeah. You know, what do you have to redo? So I break down external ballistics, right? That's what we're talking about right now. And that's kind of the cool stuff. External ballistics is the science of all the factors that affect a projectile's trajectory from the time it leaves the muzzle until it impacts the intended target, right? So.
Right.
I break it down into three categories: earth-based effects, air-based effects, and effects and gun-based effects.
Okay.
So earth-based, right? And you'll probably remember a little bit of
yes.
this. We've got a couple rotational-based effects: Coriolis effect and EOVOS effect. Coriolis effect is an effect that drifts bullets to the right in the northern hemisphere and to the left in the southern hemisphere.
I remember
hemisphere.
when the professor here told me, I said, oh, the way toilets flush different in Australia than they do in the...
Dude, I had a student come through. I've never worked in the southern hemisphere.
I just know stories.
I had a student come through. He's like, that's not true. I'm like, well, dang, I've been using
that. I thought about it growing up. Everybody told me they flushed backwards.
But, I was just trying to think of a way to illustrate it right. in people's minds. You
right.
know, I like to... So being a good instructor is very important, right? You can know all the things, but if you can't break that down into digestible material
yep.
and read a student and read their learning style and say, how can I take this and make it a version that he can comprehend?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be successful.
Well said.
You know?
Well said. It's because they come to your class, there's a lot of information coming in and you got to figure out how to get it into, even if somebody, because one of the things too, think about this, is you had to undo some bad habits for me shooting. I've been shooting rifle my whole life, killed piles of deer in my life, shot a lot of stuff, but I wanted to go to this next level. And part of it came with undoing some grip habits and some things that I'd been doing, man, since I was 7 years old with the Red Rider.
There was definitely some going through the forge with myself as well. At one point, maybe even having to look at myself in the mirror, you know, when you're not shooting as good as you want to be and you're learning these techniques that are totally foreign to you. You know, at one point I'm like, you don't know anything. Throw everything away you ever thought you knew and try and relearn it from people that actually know what they're doing or sources that are vetted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's a huge part. But back to the types of, you know.
So you got earth-based effects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you got Coriolis drifting to the right, northern hemisphere, left, southern hemisphere. EOVOS effect, which is a vertical effect based on the rotation of the earth. Think about it. If I'm shooting east, right? So the sun rises in the east, right? The sun's not moving. We're going towards the sun. It's coming up over our head. So if I am shooting at a target that's east, right, of my current position, when my bullet leaves the barrel, the target is coming over the curve of the earth towards my position, actually rising. So my bullet's going to hit low. So the projectile hits low to the east and high to the west.
And people will say, it can't make that big a difference. But when we start talking about these ranges, it is.
So one of the
at 100 yards, we don't ever notice. But.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably one of the most common questions I get is, what range does this matter?
Yeah.
At what range?
Yeah, what range does it matter?
Do you remember what I said when we were together?
I think, I don't know, what yardage you said, it was 10 or something.
No,
know.
I tell people this. Calculate everything every time because you're going to miss something. And if you're tedious about everything, you could potentially cover up an error and still get an impact.
So, right. Don't
okay. Don't worry about when it starts. Just
calculate.
Think about it. Calculate it. Now, this sounds hard, but we have software like apps in our phone that do all this for this.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I go into depth with all these topics is because I don't believe in telling somebody to do something because I said do it. I want you to know why.
Yeah. That's important.
If I can't tell you why, then
Why is it important?
The Earth spins. The bullet hits to the right. Okay, why? Well, okay, the Earth spins. That's not a good enough explanation. In the course, we go in depth into Coriolis, what it is, and where does it matter more? Where does it matter less? So we got Eovos, Coriolis. Those are your two Earth-based effects.
Okay, let's go to the air here. What do we got?
Air-based effects, big ones. These change within a particular microclimate, right? So say you go on a hunt, right? What's going to change the most from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m.? It's not going to be your geographical location. Yeah, it may change a little bit.
Right.
But the air temperature, the air pressure, the humidity, right? So air pressure, we'll talk about it. Air pressure that we're concerned with is station pressure. Station pressure is actual air pressure measured at the weather station.
Okay.
So I want to know the actual pressure. Do you know barometric pressure is station pressure corrected as if it's at sea level?
Oddly enough, in another world, I did know that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that. You know, that's not the actual station pressure, right? Lower air pressure, bullet hits high, right? Higher air pressure, more resistance on the bullet, it'll hit lower. Humidity, this is one. I'm not going to go into the why just because we're a little limited on time right now. Humidity, higher humidity, less resistance on the bullet. Bullet hits higher. Lower humidity, the bullet hits lower.
And that one's one to take into account, y'all, because that seems contrary. Right.
It's inverse.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Everybody is like, oh, high humidity. It's going to be bad. That thick air when I walked in my mailbox.
Yeah.
But nah, not to a bullet.
So we got in the air. We have barometric pressure. We have humidity.
Mm-hmm. And then one of the biggest factors, probably the second strongest factor under air pressure is temperature. Temperature is huge, and it has two effects: an external ballistics effect and an internal ballistics effect. On the external side, it's as the air heats up, becomes less dense, molecules, just think of a pot of water boiling, right? Turns into wet water vapor, right? So as the air gets hotter and the molecules space apart a little bit, the bullet sees less resistance as it's flying through the air. Colder days, your bullet's going to go through that thick, cold air and it's going to hit lower. Also, if you don't have a temperature-stable powder, which is extremely important. You need a gunpowder that's going to give you the same velocity in 30 degrees and 100 degrees. And let's say you lay your hunting ammo in the sun and it heats up 20 degrees and a lot of it doesn't have temp stable powder, your muzzle velocity could go up 20, 30 foot per second. Now all your drop charts are off.
Just because of the temperature of the ammo.
Because the temperature of the ammo changed.
Coming right back. More with Logan Copeland. And we'll talk more about the website and some of these classes coming up when we return. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward will be back with us next week. Logan Copeland, my guest. And we are talking precision, surgical precision shooting. If people want to get more info on this, you do classes. I know. I'm one of your students. And you had to do a crash course with me. It taught me a ton. Somebody wants to get signed up for a course. How does that work? Is it certain days? How do you do this?
Yep. So we have a calendar posted on the website.
Somebody just joined us.
SurgicalPrecisionTraining.com. They can go there, click on the calendar, or contact us. You can shoot me an email at SurgicalPrecisionTraining@gmail. It's the one I use. And then, I got a phone that's on there. They can give us a phone call.
Okay. So to get, and this is something too that I've seen you before, and you'll see in the social media. It's not just individuals. You got classes for
people. Yeah.
And I imagine, too, I was thinking about this maybe for season coming up or something like that, going out west, getting the guys to go out west with. Mm-hmm. As a group, all of us come out at one time and sit in the class.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's really good for guys to come with a partner, right?
Yeah.
And I treat it, it's kind of, you look back at like my sniper school days, you got like a shooter setup. You got your sniper buddy, right? Your partner. Well, we don't call it that or say that, in the course, but you've got a partner that you learn the same material with And now after you leave, you get binders with coarse material in them, and you all have the same layout there on the range. But now when you leave, you can call and be like, hey, about this particular thing, or what'd you do about reading when you're getting your wind direction? You did this. So we basically, I encourage people to come through with a group of people that's in their shooting circle,
right?
So they can stay fresh. I also, by popular request, have a private Facebook group for graduates only. That way they can get together with
people
that
have— Okay, kind of compare notes.
Yeah, people that have the same training and basically to share similar concepts, right?
Well, it's, and that's good because there's a lot to digest in this. You've rolled through some of these, but in the, you know, there's a lot of what you call it about the math of this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, thank goodness you said, like, you hooked me up with my rangefinder has an app and all that, but you made sure before you ever let me turn that on, because I just wanted to go, okay, let's turn the thing on and make it that, like, you made sure I understood what it was doing and why.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's kind of hard. Like a kid with new Christmas toy, I had the new rangefinder. I just wanted to turn it on and start mashing buttons.
Right. But right.
Didn't work that way.
So, yeah, you know, it's what I'm really trying to work on when people come to this course. They think it's their guns, you know, but it's their brain.
Yeah.
I'm trying to work on your brain.
Yeah, and you did. Yeah, it was like, and it's not like you say, well, the only way you can accomplish this shot is you have to buy this rifle that's $26,000. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't say that. You said, you know, I had the rifle I was hunting with, the round I was hunting with. You know, and did a little bit of work on it and tuning it for me, but you taught me to use what I was shooting.
So that's a very interesting thing to bring up, right? So, like, not only do we do shooting courses, like, we have our own line of rifles,
right.
Surgical precision, we have our own actions. So, you know, at that point, you know, someone can go down that road, get a very expensive rifle that does a lot of things for them. We sell optics. However, let's look at the facts. The facts are, a half-inch group doesn't know if it's coming out of a Ruger American or a surgical precision flatline.
Right.
A half-inch group is a half-inch group.
Yes.
Now, it may not have the ergonomics. It may not be as good-looking or as reliable or as consistent, you know, as maybe one of our rifles would be.
Right.
But it still, most of the time, shoots, you know, if it shoots half inch, it still shoots half inch.
Right.
And that's the same thing with, like, conditioning your mind. So the things that I teach people in the course, they're not secret classified materials. You can learn these things on YouTube. You can learn these online. But the difference would be is you probably are going to have to filter through about 5 years of bullcrap that's on the internet.
And also, I mean, you know, you taught like the class portion, and then when you and I are on the range, I appreciate that because we did a thing, and then, okay, let's, like, what do you taught, the repeatability of that thing, or whatever the term is, and you could show me, by watching me, what I did to change that, okay, what, I thought I did everything exactly the same, Logan, you're like, no, actually, did you see that you did X?
Right.
And then once the brain starts looking, then I could, you know, retraining that, I guess.
Right. You know, and that comes through, like, just, good Lord, man, I've spent time with thousands and thousands of people on flat lines critiquing marksmanship fundamentals, right? And I like to teach things in concepts. So, like, we'll talk, like, marksmanship fundamentals for a second. You know, something that's really big in the community right now is like, oh, I found out that I can use a tripod on the front and a set of shooting sticks in the rear, or I can use a tripod in the rear and a hiking bag in the front. You know, marksmanship fundamentals, to me, I have a couple macro concepts that apply. Number one, the earth is the most stable thing that we have.
Mm-hmm.
You're always going to have it with you.
Yeah.
Every hunt you go on, you'll have the earth. It'll be there.
Yeah. Light pack, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Number two is try to connect your rifle to the earth with as much contact as possible. Minimum of 2 points of contact. So if you're having to make a long-range shot and you're just on a bipod and you're laying prone, but you're holding the buttstock up in the air and your arms are up in the air because you don't have your bipod set up right, you don't have 2 points of contact.
Right.
There's another way you can connect that rifle to the earth. I don't care how you do it. You can do it off of a soda can. You can do it off, I'd probably use a shooting bag.
Right.
But as long as you can apply those concepts, if you can think it, you can do it, you know?
This is truly, y'all, the tip of the iceberg. So we're going to have you come back again and pick it up where we leave off.
Yeah. All right. I'd love to, man.
And in the meantime, y'all check him out online. Once again, the website?
SurgicalPrecisionTraining.com.
All right. We'll see you over there on the website and the Facebook page. And we'll be back next week for another edition of FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors.